We'll open the Senate Revenue Committee for Tuesday, what's today?
25th.
Tuesday the 25th of January. Today we have the Oregon Lottery. We're going to have a presentation by Mazen Malik from the Legislative Revenue Office, and then we're going to have Mr. Dale Penn, who is our new administrator of the Oregon State Lottery, to talk about all the salient issues facing the lottery. Paul, anything before we proceed?
That's it, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm sorry.
Thank you again for the refreshments.
Well, I'm going to keep bringing you back until we get it eaten up.
I'm doing my part. Good morning, Matt. Mazen.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office, and I will do a quick overview of the Oregon Lottery today for you. This is probably just to lay the grounds for some understanding of the lottery. And again, these balls here are not necessarily in any order or indication of any numbers that would be winning. But for the most part, I think a lot of people, when they think of the Oregon Lottery, the first thing that they want to talk about is winning and probably celebrating. And again, this guy opening a champagne bottle would make the nexus with my beverage and beer alcohol tax that we talked about before. But from your vantage point, there's other things that you get to talk about. And first of all, we'll talk about terminology in order to lay the ground for what we would be discussing. Quick history, what net proceeds are, and that's both for traditional and video lottery. And then basically what transfers go to the state and the general fund and so on, other funds. And quickly touch on some issues that keep coming when we discuss the lottery in different venues. Now, a quick terminology kind of definitions and agreement revenue when it comes to lotteries, basically associated with the game. And then the other section of revenue that you would see are things like interest and unclaimed prizes. Those also constitute part of the revenues that lottery does. Prizes, of course, are the ones that players win. And in that, once we introduce those two definitions, revenue and prices, we'll introduce here what net receipts. And that is, for the benefit of the discussion, will be game revenues less prices, which means expenses have not been taken into effect in the net receipts definition. Then we will introduce expenses, both for the game and the operating expenses, as well as what known as the contingency reserves for the lottery. And once those are introduced, then we will have net proceeds. And net proceeds will be the net receipts, which we've defined up here, and less those expenses that we've defined. Now, the quick hit in lottery history, we have in 84, it was created by an initiative petition, introduced additional games, net proceeds were dedicated to economic development. In 89, there was legislative action that created sports action and authorized the video lottery. However, it was at that time, in 89, suspended by the governor. The 1991 legislature reintroduced or reauthorized the video lottery, as well as prohibited other private lotteries, and dedicated 2.5% of net receipts to counties also for the benefit of economic development in the counties. In 95, legislature referred Measure 21, which added financing public education and gave lottery bonds first claim on revenue, dedicated 15% of net proceeds to what is known at that time as the Educational Endowment Fund. The 98 ballot measure 66 dedicated 15% to parks and beaches and watershed protections. And just to have to come more recent in history, in 99, legislative action dedicated not less than 1% of the net proceeds to problem gambling. And finally, in 2002, the third special session made a legislative referral and converted the Education Endowment Fund into the Education Stabilization Fund, the ESF. And in that, it made a dedication. If the fund balance is less than 5% of the general fund, then 18% would go to the Education Stability Fund or Stabilization Fund. And if it's at that point, if it has reached 18%, then it would be 15% going to the school capital matching sub-account. Also allowed appropriation of principal and conditional also on 35 plus votes. And traditional lottery games, just to get a quick idea on how they came in 2003-04, net receipts came into those percentages, and as you would see on the traditional, this is not including the video, you have 34%, here being the largest in the net receipts, followed by Fino, and then comes the multi-state lottery is what defines the Powerball. And previous to that, it used to be known as Lotto America, I guess. The amount for the 03-04, 127.4, and now I think it's appropriate, once we started talking about the amounts and money, is to go to Green Up Posture and talk about traditional game revenues. A picture quickly tracing the revenue traditional games would show how it went when it started back here, how small it was, and then how it grew with time. And you'd see also that it was a jump in the 91-92. This was commensurate with the introduction of the video lottery. So, in a way, video have helped also traditional game revenue. To take a different look at how the revenue came in percentages, regardless of the amounts of the different year, you would see that the net revenue, which is the lowest segment of the graph, in a way, if you would trace it, it is... Oops. Forget that mistake. Didn't go that bad.
There goes the state.
Yes.
The cost of printing the paper.
However, the expenses, and if you remember, the expenses are capped at 16%. However, they kept about the same. They went down a little bit and then maintained that percentage out of the total. And you would see that the segment that was increasing primarily was prizes all the time.
And yeah, that's another George.
Are we running, because that prize spread is getting broader and broader. Is that necessary to hold the interest? Is that why that's being done that way?
I suspect part of maintaining interest of players and so on, that the prizes were going up. But there is also the video lottery as you would see in coming few minutes, that it has also a higher threshold for prizes. So I think, in a way, that was, if you will, an accompanying and a corollary to the definition. Vidulari, you would see the quick, steep increase that it went through, and in the same token that we were discussing, the level of prizes and how much they make out of the total Vidulari revenue. Now, when we're talking about revenue here, we're talking about the gross revenue. This means all the money you put in the machines, all the money that one would win and puts and plays again. So it's the churn, if you will. And this is not necessarily all money that people have put into the machines, but so dollar per dollar, whatever have been going through the machine itself. If you look at the same picture that we looked at when it comes to percentages, regardless of the amounts, you would see that when it started, Vidulari started with expenses of about 8%, and it kept going down in time until it got back down to 2.4%. So it was coming down and shrinking with time. Net revenue, however, kept increasing, and up here it's about, we're talking about 6.2%. And as you see, the prizes still comprise the largest amount of total revenue. Now, putting both traditional and video together gives you the total picture, if you will. And before the introduction of video, you could see how small the amounts were down until 1992, and then the jump that it just went through and continued on and on. And I remember a long time ago when we started trying to forecast the lottery, that Paul was involved at that time. We were just so dumbfounded how quickly it just keeps going and going and going, and it's not stopping. So it defied all logical models and what we were expecting of, you know, specific amount of money that people are willing to gamble, but it actually just kept on. However, this also shows, yes, net revenue did go up, even though slightly. You cannot necessarily see it in this graph, but you would see it in the other one when it comes and puts percentages back in again. Mm. However, one picture becomes interesting, seeing in the earlier years, before the introduction of video, the net revenue segment of the total was higher. Now, remember, those from the previous graph were really small amounts. However, when you talk about percentages, it was high. Same thing with expenses. It was large with the small graphs. However, when you introduce video, which is also its percentage of expense, is only 2.4%, your expenses also shrank with time. So you have shrinking of expenses. However, the prizes, you could see how they work in here with the bright colors, and how net revenue keeps, in a way, going down or holding steady. Although, when you look at the real numbers of what these transfers and prizes are, these are not necessarily indicative of that kind of. You see that it is keeps going up and up, even with that smaller amount. And those transfers have the other dedications that we've talked about in the beginning with the history, having the beginning of the lottery was all economic development. Then the bonds came in, and if that is interesting issue to look at is the bonding out of the lottery, and it's in the red, I mean yellow, not that colorblind. The yellow keeps going bigger and bigger, so lottery transfers are being reserved more and more for bonds, which, as we spoke before, takes the first shot at the amounts. Of course, the Parks and Recreation became a steady 15%, and the other bars are still Education Stability Fund right here, and so on. Going back to the away from the greener phosphorus, if you will, I'm talking about lottery distributions. For the 305 biennium, this is the biennium we're still in, so the biennium is not over yet. The estimates at this point is about 718.8 million. They come and they're basically budgeted or spent in these percentages. 17% for the bonds, education stability is at 19%, parks and recreation, counties, and then the largest segment is legislative appropriation. That is what the legislature has to or able to channel towards or within the system. I'm going to have a quick discussion of the issues, not necessarily because this is exactly what we see or what takes precedence in the level of order, but because the issues that you could see and tease out of the graphs and the other discussions and concerns of different players in the sense of revenue and budget players, not necessarily.
They're players too, you know.
that's
according to your prior chart. Yeah.
So the line games are becoming an issue that are having a lot of players. Video payout percentages, as we have discussed, and retailer compensation is also a hot issue that are being discussed over and over again. And, of course, always a discussion about expenses. Just to quickly hit on the line games, I looked in our records and see what we had before the line games and estimates of February 2002. This is not new by no means. That was the estimate that I found at that time. 80 million for the 0305, and then 0507 between 80 to 130 million. This is a range. The bullseye, if you see, is just symbolic of can we get that bullseye kind of estimate into the line games, and the answer is I really don't know at this point.
Madison, do you know, did we anticipate or predict, I suspect not, in the early 90s video poker would take off like it did? If the same people were sitting here 10 years ago and were looking at the video poker and saw 80 to 120, would have, my suspicion is it went exponentially higher than what we were predicting.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we were not expecting it to grow as quickly as it did, nor as much as it did. However, once we started seeing, we were still sometimes in disbelief of its continuation of how much and how quick it is going. That is true also for all the issue of gambling. I don't know if you remember, there was a lot of talk at times when the Native American casinos started opening in a lot of places that this is going to drain and sap all that business from Las Vegas and so on. What it seems like what turned out to be is those are training grounds. People go and play a little bit and get some prep and then go and do the $80 billion business in Las Vegas these days for gambling. So there are things that are happening within the habits and the pleasures that people are drawing out of these games. So that is it doable? I mean, probably. Is it something beyond our expectations? Also probably, but it would be always important to see what is in competition, what happens, who's drawing how much, and how much is a pie growing, if you will, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm. Paul?
Just a little note on history, but what Mazen said is certainly true, that we did exceed our expectations in the initial phases and grew very rapidly, but it hasn't been all smooth, and there was a period in the mid-90s, in the 95-97 session, where we did overestimate lottery revenue. That was when the tribal games came on. Mm-hmm. And some of you may recall that we had a special session in 96 in order to, at that time, fortunately, general fund revenue was exceeding expectations and lottery revenue was coming in short. So there was a readjustment of the budget, but the legislature came in special session and moved a part of the school fund, state school funding from the lottery to the general fund in order to make up that shortfall. So it wasn't that we weren't growing, it's just that our rate of growth slowed down when those tribal casinos came in and actually slowed down more than we had anticipated when the legislatively approved budget was put together in 95.
Who missed that forecast?
We can overestimate as well. We have done that in the past.
That is, after all, I mean, there is a limit to how much people will spend. I mean, and we think we, with time, we will know more and more about it.
Mm-hmm.
The second issue that we've seen of interest in many times is how the percentage that prizes comprise out of the total, and you could see with the introduction of not necessarily video, but here's the time that Paul is talking about, there needed to be more prizing introduced in order to make now the annual growth. And it's interesting and very instructive when you look at this chart, how the net have grown and grown earlier, faster than anything else, and then how it tapered off and growth continued going. But here we started capturing a lot more of the percentages as the prizes and net dipping here in the 89-99 for the first time in percentage growth terms. And then you see a new trend almost being established in this area. Finally, I really didn't want to discuss too much details with the rates, but I thought with the discussions that are happening all over the place, it's probably important to see how the old rates were. Annual net receipts, if you are a retailer that makes up to 200,000, your rate that you get to keep is about 35% of those net receipts. When you get to that bracket of 200 to 400,000, now, you've already paid on this. Okay. The second layer, so you're paying basically in layers, is the 30%, and the third layer is 25%, and once you exceed 600,000, you do 20%. And if you put all these together and you blend them, what you're getting is about 32%. Now, in 2004, there was a new set of rates introduced. They basically come in two choices, the three-tier option with the up to 175,000, you're keeping 32.5, 175 to 475, 26, and then the threshold that you exceed of 475,000, you get to keep 17%. Now, the second option that you get the choice to either exercise, and you have to make that choice every year before you start the year, probably after the time that you had to assess your business, is up to $650,026, and over that, 19% is what you get to keep, for an overall blended rate of about 28.8%. That was the estimate. Now remember, this we have not built enough experience to establish precisely how these would work. When we're looking at year to date through December of this year, what we have seen is about 30.3%.
30.3.
Right. In the month of December, it was about 29%. So I think we're still establishing some level of knowledge with this idea. Now, retailer compensation, and I have to say this, I really didn't want to get too much into this discussion, but again, as I mentioned before, trying to keep an economist from discussing these different issues, like keeping a child from unwrapping a candy bar, so I had to take a shot at it. The retailer compensation, a debate ensues about who gets the better deal of this thing. And there's one point of view about the revenue basically says, if, and remember this is a hypothetical example, if you're getting gross revenues of these amounts, about $450 million, and you are going to get it anyhow, it is constant, it's a straight line, and it continues going. If retailer compensation is going on this axis, so whatever percentage that you give retailers, you are basically deducting from gross revenue, and that's what you end up with, a declining net revenue in that sense. So if you are thinking that you'll take, in the 90s, net revenues will be very small. However, if you, under this model, could assume that if you give them 1% or none, you'll get all the revenue. However, that probably not the only point of view of looking at this. The other point of view of the debate, if you will, it says you actually, if you don't give retailers nothing, there is no incentive in marketing, no incentive in pushing the games or keeping the amounts of or the numbers of machines, not drawing the customers. So the more incentive there is, yes, gross revenue will go, keep going with the incentive type of arrangement. However, net revenue, it will keep going up for a while and then starts declining, reaching the same conclusion at the end, which both points of view agree to. However, it becomes important is when and where to set the right amount of opening, if you will, between the two lines. And of course, if we put the two lines together, they intersect. And I have to mention that in the discipline in economics, intersecting lines mean big deal for economists. So
I'll write that down.
Yeah. So if we could determine where that intersection is, we think we have achieved nirvana. We found God, kind of thing. If that is true, then we have determined what is the ultimate or the maximizing profits or maximizing revenue type of arrangement. Now, again, I want to remind you that this is just in the theoretical rather than giving any hints on which compensation rate is the right one. But if we reach that, we can analyze it to that satisfaction rate. Lastly, the issue of lottery expense percents. You would see, again, with the introduction of video, it started going from the 16% neighborhood that's what it would stay if we're only looking at traditional. But when you put the total together, this is where video is in the black line. When you put them all together with respect to revenue, you would see all the drop that continues in the matter of the expenses that are taken away from the game. So the introduction of video, obviously lower overhead, lower expense, lower amounts, brings the whole percentage of the expenses down. And with that, I've done my part for this game, and I'll take any of your questions. And
thank you, Maz, and that was perfect. And, you know, going from property taxes to beer, wine, and lottery is definitely become the fun economist in legislative revenue. Questions or thoughts for Mazin? Thank you.
Okay, I'll start the next presentation that Director Dave Penn would do, and I'll just give him the bridge or the mouse or the what do you call it?
He should know this, although he's new to that. I don't know how long you've been there. What is the little lever?
The one arm bandit.
Vegas.
My name is Dale Penn. I am the lottery director, and I'm happy to be here today. I will say that if the Lottery Commission does approve line games tomorrow, I guess it's a lot of people say, what are line games? And they really are video slot machines, but they do not have the arm on the side. And they, by our constitutional standard, they are not allowed to pay out coins. And so they look a little different than you might imagine the regular, quote, slot machine. But it does play the same type of game without the arm.
Sorry to interrupt you early. So my understanding is they have a chip that all y'all have to, if you approve it tomorrow, the chip can be turned on. And how quickly will you have the line games up in?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is the kind of perhaps shorthand myth about line games, that all we have to do is flip a switch. It is much more complicated than that. However, most of the machines in the field right now do have the capability and are programmed for some type of line games. And so in that analysis, there is a process that we can go through to, in effect, activate those games. But it is a much more complicated process than just flipping a switch. We do believe that it is a very aggressive timeline to be available by July, but we also believe that we can do that. That is one reason that I asked the commission to make a decision tomorrow, because we would need that 5 months, and even that will be pushing the limits. So. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I'm going to quickly go through some of this material. You have a handout. Much of what I might give as a background has already been developed for you just in the previous presentation. Simply state that our mission statement is to operate a lottery with the highest standards of integrity and security, and that's very important, that the people of Oregon trust the integrity of the games. And the fact that the Oregon Lottery does control the games, does test their integrity and their security, I think is very important to the success of the Oregon Lottery. And perhaps one reason that you've seen in the last few years, people with law enforcement background come into the lottery, that certainly was my background, I think it helps that position of integrity and security. But it is our mission is to earn the maximum profits for the people of Oregon commensurate with the public good. Those are words that carry a lot of meaning, and certainly that is our goal, to maximize the profits. Our structure is a five-member commission. Two of those commissioners have some specific criteria before they can be members of the commission. One needs to have a law enforcement background. The other needs to be a CPA. The other three members of the commission are more general. All five members of the commission are nominated by the governor and go through a process of review and confirmation by the Senate.
And you have one member open?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have one opening at the present time, and that is our CPA member. And so it is our hope that that position can be filled as soon as possible.
As soon as possible, but no name has surfaced.
Mr. Chair, at this time I'm unaware of a nominee to go to the Senate at this stage, but I know the governor's office is working on that process and trying to come up with someone. It is a little more complicated because there has to be a balance of political affiliation as well on the commission. And so when we have one opening, many times that means it must be a person from a particular party to meet the balanced political makeup of the commission. And so that's another complicator.
Profession and affiliation you have to find.
I am the director and just went through the process of appearing before the Senate and have been on the job officially for 2 months. Again, appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. And then we have assistant director. Security, again, is a very important part. Actually, we contract with Oregon State Police to provide security for the lottery. They do background investigations. They test games. They maintain a secure environment for all of our games and for the computer networks that run those games. We are a sales organization, so we have an assistant director for marketing. Retail operations is actual sales and repair of the equipment in the field, and then just running our organization itself, we have an assistant director for support services, finance, IT, all of those functions. I'm going to skip over the history. I think you've heard that. The main important point is that the voters established in the Constitution the Lottery Commission, the Lottery Fund, to operate as a self-supporting revenue-raising agency. Again, quickly hit this, that this is the manner in which the Constitution and the legislature has chosen to divide up the dollars that we transfer to the state. And then, excuse me, game development. Over the years, you've seen a change in games, starting with Scratch-Its and Megabucks. We've had those since the very beginning, but then we've tried to bring in new games to keep sales going. The legislature has initiated a couple of games, sports action and video lottery. Down at the bottom of commission-initiated games, I've placed line games, and as I said, that meeting is tomorrow for them to make that decision. And whether or not they would vote to do that, we'll determine after tomorrow.
Dale?
Yes?
Just on that sports action, do you know, and I realize that you're new to the job, the rationale, we don't have the full choice of sports on there. So I was asked the other day by someone who plays college football and the football and sports action why they're not offered professional baseball, basketball. I guess basketball would be problematic because we have a team here.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, I asked that same question, and then I was reminded about some of the history. We were sued by the National Football League, and we are the only state that has a program that allows for betting on games. And I guess the negotiation was they left us alone. However, they will not allow any professional football team to come to the state of Oregon. That's part of our punishment. So it becomes very complex. If we would try to move into baseball or anything else, we're going to run into major, legal battles on that. And so we've just stuck with our program that we've had, and we haven't tried to expand it out.
I've always been interested if there's a way, you know, my understanding of sports action is the reason that we don't get the NCAA basketball, any of the basketball tournaments and all the revenue and visitors that come with that is because of sports action. And so I've always been at least interested. I know Randy Miller and myself looked at it. It's just replacing that revenue to the athletic departments at U of O, OSU, and PSU. But if you ever find some solution to that, I think it would really... They go to Boise, Sacramento, Seattle, and they just miss Oregon, and it would be wonderful to be able to replace sports action with something and draw that visitor base to Oregon.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that's something to continue to look at, because when there are choices made frequently, there are negative implications for this choice, and that's an example of some of those negatives.
Okay.
Simply identify that there has been changes in games, and we have seen a continual increase in sales throughout the years, and some of the different types of games and when we brought them on, and the impact. Quickly, I'll hit the budget process, that we are a zero-based budgeting organization. We look at our past year's plan and performance measures. A strategic plan is developed for us by the commission. We take that strategic plan, for instance, at the tomorrow's meeting, the commission will approve our strategic plan for next budget cycle, next year. We will develop business plans, marketing plan, financial plan from that strategic plan. There will be projects that will be designated to assist in accomplishing the goals. We develop measurements of the different projects and submit our plans to the governor's office for review and to the commission, and ultimately they are adopted by the commission, and that would be our budget process to develop our budget for next year, business year, beginning July to June. Again, you have seen this presentation about revenue and expense distribution. Simply say that here you'll see that traditional games do have different prize payouts by game, but overall it's about 64%. The Constitution mandates it must be at least 50%. Transfers to the state, you'll see, are almost 19% in 2004. That is roughly $60 million. At that 19% amount. But then when you look at video lottery, as you've been told, this changes dramatically. You'll see that transfers to the state are only 3.7%. And yet, the important thing here is that, this particular product is so popular, and this pie, the circumference is huge in comparison. So a 3.7% amount here is $292 million. In the last two fiscal years, that's been basically $600 million transferred to the state of Oregon. Prize payouts also, it started around 89%, and we are now in the 93%. Thank you very much. And some of that is the fact that the public does pick and choose which games are popular, and they do individually have some different payouts. And what occurred about 6 years ago was a new game was developed for video poker, and it now is the game on every terminal. We have tried to tinker with it a little bit, and we've seen changes in sales when we tinker with it, so we have to leave it alone, but it does have a higher payout. Now, so the lesson there is that it becomes very important when you roll out a game to be very precise about what is the standard, what is an appropriate payout, because it has implications for years as long as that game is in play. That is one of the issues that we would be examining for line games. And I would tell you that the industry standard, as we look at other lotteries and that utilize video, is about 92%. So that may change the makeup of this prize payout if, in fact, we implement a line game that is popular at 92%. But it's one of those things that we have to examine very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
The contingency reserve was discussed or brought up, and I think it's very important to remember that the lottery has to be a self-supporting agency. Therefore, we can't borrow money. We can't wait for money to come in. We have to have money in our checkbook today to pay our bills. And the manner in which that is done is with a contingency reserve account. This is established by the Lottery Commission. By the end of December, you see that our reserve contained $95 million. Now, that seems like a lot of money. However, immediately, you have to recognize that $52 million of that is, in effect, assets, equipment. So that's not available for us to pay bills. So what we really had on December 31st was $43 million in cash. We have to maintain $20 million in cash at all times just to pay bills, pay payroll, assign contracts, that type of thing. So in effect, we carry about a $23 million contingency in our budget in case something happens that we could not foresee or we run into problems. What we will do with that is that if we retain that as contingency, that would roll over as a resource in our next year's budget. And primarily it's used because of capital requirements. So I've tried to look at what are the capital needs that we're going to have in the next 2 years. And you can see that they can be dramatic. $63 million is what we project. Almost the entire amount of that is to replace obsolete video lottery terminals that are in the field. We now have 2,000 terminals in the field that are not supported in software or hardware. In effect, we can't buy parts for them. So if there's a problem, we have to cannibalize from other machines that we own to try to keep a set number of these machines running. They are 10 to 12 years old. The standard is that we should be replacing these every 4 years, maybe 5 years. We have been way off on doing that, and now we have the bill to pay for these 2,000 machines. One other thing about them, because of their age, they cannot support line games. And so they do not have any programming available for line games. So if there is a decision to move the line games, that's another obsolescence of this particular product. We also have 2,500 other machines that are about 10 years old. They do support line games. But their software is no longer supported. We still have the capability to purchase parts, mechanical parts, if they go out, but we have the problem of software. A bigger problem with this machine is the bill acceptor. And that's just a little part of the machine. It will accept that $20, $10, $5 bill for playing the game. The United States government has been changing its currency. And we are now looking at those 2,500 terminals that their bill acceptor will not accept all of the currency in this next fiscal year. Because it's no longer supported, just trying to change this bill acceptor is going to push us in the millions of dollars to where you have to look at, isn't it more cost-effective to purchase a new machine rather than to repair this 12-year-old machine, 10-year-old machine that is no longer supported in software? So there are some real choices out there, and we feel like we're at the end of the line for those particular products, and they do have a cost. We also have a network, a computer network, that connects all of our traditional lottery products, the little red box if you went in and bought a Megabucks ticket, or if you received a scratch-it ticket and it's a winner, they're going to screen it on our computer network, but also runs our video network. And really, all of these individual machines and how much money is going in there and what the retailers owe for that machine. We're in the process of having to upgrade that central system, and that's going to have a cost of $7 million for us to keep that moving forward. I think it becomes very important when you look at the gross dollars. There was a figure up there of $9 billion a year. Now, that includes this churn factor. That isn't $9 billion actually placed into all the machines and all the lottery network. But it does emphasize the complexity and the huge numbers involved and the need to have that central system that is able to process that amount of dollars.
Senator Metzger.
Director Pitt, back to your point about the aging terminals, et cetera. And I know you're relatively new to this, so I keep that in mind. But in terms of there are a number of manufacturers, not a lot of them, that pretty well have a corner on this type of business in the United States. But are you satisfied, I guess the way to put this, are you satisfied with the negotiating approach that the state has used in the past in terms of negotiating purchase or lease of equipment? If you're equipping a hospital with card access, part of the thing is you want to make sure you don't get locked into a particular vendor who will not service, who will not be able to contend with additions to your facility, and that's all, supporting that network is part of the sales decision process. Mm-hmm. And have we maximized the value to the state in negotiating with the providers of this hardware and software so that support and replacement is part of the negotiation tool that we use?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, I think that's a very good question, and I don't know that I can answer about the purchases made 12 years ago, 10 years ago, that type of thing. I do know that it is something that is very important to the organization now. It is something that we do look at, and we do have several different manufacturers of our machines. And one of the reasons we look at that and trying to maintain more than just one supplier is so that we can have competition between in our market between manufacturers. One of the things that's unique about Oregon, though, is we are the only video lottery that confined itself to poker. And so we kind of put ourselves at a disadvantage because all of these manufacturers, the big game nationwide and worldwide in a video lottery situation is line games. And so here is Oregon saying, well, okay, that's nice, but we don't want line games, we want poker. And poker is a small game in all of the other gambling enterprises throughout the world and the United States. So that has somewhat limited our capability to encourage competition, but we have still been able to do that. The other big thing that I think Oregon has accomplished that has been a major plus for us is that manufacturers would like to come to us and say, give us a percentage of the take. And we see nationwide, most lotteries just saying, that's fine with us. We don't have to mess with it. We'll give you, you give the machines to us and you just give us our cut. We think it is much better for us to own the machines, for us to set the standards, both for security, but also that we are not held hostage. Because I think that is what happens to a lottery when you turn that over to a vendor. And so I do think we have positioned ourselves well, but that is a very important point and certainly one that we will put as our number one priority as we go forward.
Thank you.
The idea of one thing I learned is the lottery is audited many times by many people. And so this just identifies, we just finished the Secretary of State's audit, no material findings. We have a security review that's being finished, and we're very proud of the fact that we're being told by the review that Oregon's lottery meets or exceeds best practices of U.S. lotteries in all categories. We have a full staff of internal auditors, and we're continually reviewing our process, and we have an audit committee on the commission to review the internal audit process and what issues we identify. And so we feel that that has moved forward very well.
Do you know, was that all, and this is far beyond your arrival at the lottery, but the celebrated cases of, I think it was the China and first-class plane tickets. It sounds to me like you failed the audit process that we have in place now in the new commission, and your arrival and your predecessors has cleaned all of that type of activity out of the lottery.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe so, and we've tried to. I think the challenge that came forward was the lottery is a unique state agency, and you really are a sales organization. And there are times, and we do have some exemption from different state processes if it's necessary. But I think it became the norm for a period of time, and really the state agency part of it kind of got set aside. And clearly that's been put back in the forefront, and I think we're in good shape from that perspective. I'll quickly hit this next one, the forecast. I think there was some misunderstandings about what amount of increase there was being projected in the governor's recommended budget, because there is a total of $933 million identified coming from the lottery in the governor's recommended budget. But I think that immediately you have to subtract the $120 million that is projected for line games to be able to compare what this number really means. When you look at the forecast and what was actually being transferred this biennium, we are going to transfer $770 million this biennium. And then you see that what is being projected for us is $813 million. And so that really ties up closely with the 5.4% increase over the next 2 years forecasted for us. And that really is focused on economic conditions. So I think that is a solid forecast. That is a solid number, the 813. Then we've tried to look at the 120, and you've already heard a little bit about that. Oregon does not have an exact duplicate that we can go look at and say they were a poker operation and now they've added line games and what was the increase that they saw. So we tried to look at what organizations have done in adding line games and what types of increases they saw, and we saw a range of basically $50 million to $170 million. And so I think the 120 does fit in close to the middle there. When you really analyze it, it would require us to make about a 10 to 11% increase in sales just because of line games to be able to generate that $120 million. When you look at it that way, then I think it becomes a much more realistic number and something that we can do if we can get up and going by July and have everyone enthusiastically promoting this product and the public is aware of it. I really think that can happen. I did try to look at one state that the Secretary of State would say West Virginia really doesn't match us very well because they have a casino operation, and every other state that has video lottery has casinos, and we do not. The state-run casinos. So that makes it difficult to compare them. However, West Virginia also has a retailer network like Oregon's. And so we isolated out the casino operations and we said, let's compare your video retailer network with our video retailer network. And let's look at the amount of dollars that West Virginia uses or pays through its video lottery games. And let's look at the amount of dollars that Oregon citizens pay through our video lottery network. And what we see, and then the only difference you would really see is they have line game products, we do not. They have line game and poker products, we have simply poker. And what we saw was at a state that has a more depressed economy, it's smaller, but just looking at per capita, you would see a 17% growth in the amount of dollars that are put through per capita their video network compared to Oregon. Now, we just look at that and say, we think that's about the most we could expect some change to happen in Oregon. We'll just put that out there as the maximum. But again, we believe the 10 to 11% becomes a realistic figure with that. I simply show this next chart because it does show the growth of the video lottery sales network, and the last several areas and years are the projections. You'll see that dip in there around 1998 and so, and that's really where we saw the growth of casinos in Oregon, and you can see how the flattening took place. But then we've started coming back, and I think we've had a stabilization, and the video product has continued to increase each year. The last thing I'd say, this is the 20th anniversary of the lottery, and in that 20 years, the lottery has produced $4 billion to the state of Oregon to help economic development, support schools, improve parks, rebuild watersheds, and dedicate some of those resources for problem gambling. We're very proud of that, and the employees there are very proud of it. I think that's one thing about the job that attracted me to it, to bring resources to state government, because there's many needs, and certainly I understand the needs for that. The one thing that I'll say in comparison, if you note, $4 billion in that 20 years. If we are successful in meeting the goals that have been put forward and hitting that $933 million per biennium amount, you will see the lottery very quickly transferring $1 billion every biennium rather than the $4 billion over the first 20 years. So it becomes a substantial resource to the state. But with that, I've talked on and on, but I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. I appreciate your willingness to have me here today.
Thank you, Director Penn. And I think we should always note, it's one of my favorite lines that I've encountered here in state government, is the lottery is not for investment purposes. Whenever I see or hear that, I don't know what the genesis of that coming onto our machines was, but...
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, I will say the lottery's motto is it does good things. And that is what we're trying to do about the schools, the economic development. And I really do believe it does good things as long as people can understand it is entertainment. It is not investment. And that becomes the important message and what you also see on all of our products.
Correct. Thank you. Questions for Director Penn? I have just a couple of them, and they're around the compensation issue. I have, and I'm sure you have received, just a great deal of material. I've got it since I arrived here 2 or 3 weeks ago. And in fairness, it's from one side. It's from the side that feels that the retailers are being overcompensated and have historically been well overcompensated. And I really welcome the information from the Restaurant Association on the other side of this argument.
Yeah.
One of the things that does seem compelling to me is that the Lottery Commission has had reports from Eco Northwest, from KPMG. I know Joe Coatwright has done some, and I've just been flipping through them, and I have someone in my office that is looking at them too. And they seem to all have a common thread through them, which is... I think the KPMG one said that they would suggest that 10 to 20% and anything after that would be an excess in terms of retailer compensation. The Eco Northwest one, I believe, and it was commissioned by the Lottery Commission, if I'm not mistaken, says that after $10,000, then, you know, $10,000 to have the machines in the establishment, after that, a lot of the profits would be excessive, at least in due to the mission of the lottery, which is to return dollars to state services. And so I guess my question, I know you're new to this position and didn't play a part in prior decisions, but what is the rationale? If those are correct, if Joe Coatwright's analysis is correct, what is the rationale behind a 26.5% recommendation? Given what at least outside economists have provided?
Well, Mr. Chair, that is a complicated issue, and everyone has wanted to discuss that before we've gotten to the point of saying that line games is going to happen. So I've tried to put people off on that until after tomorrow. If the commission voted no, we don't even have this discussion. But I have examined the issue because we are being sued. Over the commission rates, which were a blended rate, and let me use that term because that's the number that gets bandied about, and you'll see in the media, this blended rate. And so the present commission blended rate is between 28 and 29. And you heard the discussion about, well, right now is like 30.3, but you got to understand that there's levels, and so the first 6 months you're at the higher levels, percentages. The second 6 months of the year, you're going to see lower returns. I'm very confident that when you look at the whole year here, it's going to be in somewhere between 28 and 29. But that was the number. Historically, you go back and look and see what happened. They had an independent study. Legislature was involved in it, and it was done back when video lottery started, and the number that was given was 35%. A number of other jurisdictions also identified 35% as the appropriate number to start up this game, to give a reasonable rate of return, and yet to maximize profits. So then, as this went forward, then the legislature looked at this, and you mentioned Mr. Courtright. He was actually legislative staff to a committee that was specifically studying what is the appropriate number. And he came forward very clearly with his presentation about it should be 15%. That committee did not adopt that, did not take action on that. All of that material was examined because there was my point being, there was a lot of other discussion. And the real difficulty here is we're talking about a product and human conduct. Mm-hmm. And it isn't, I like the presentation that you received, that you're trying to find, there isn't straight lines here. These really are elliptical curves, and we are all trying to forecast where is the closest number here. And that's very difficult to do. My concern is this. The video product is projected to produce for the state budget $660 million without discussing line games. If line games come into play, we're talking about in the budget now, at least the governor's recommended budget, $780 million in effect as base. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at it, in the last 2 years, this retailer network produced $600 million at a certain rate, commission rate, and we are reducing that about 10% because this contract just started 6 months ago. So we're going to cut that commission rate, and we're saying to those retailers, we want you to produce not only the $600 million you did the last 2 years, we want an additional $60 million because we believe that there's growth there. And, oh, by the way, we want you to produce another $120 million. And if we take the analysis that 15% flat rate is appropriate, we'd be saying, and besides producing all of that, we want you to take a 50% cut in return. Mm-hmm. Now, that is just an overview of what we're saying. What I have said, and I think as the director, is that line games will increase sales. And I think everyone agrees with that. The problem is trying to identify exactly how much it will produce. And our goal is to make sure that $120 million is transferred to the state of Oregon as a base budget amount. So to accomplish that, we must reduce retailer compensation to some degree. But you also have to understand they are our sales force. Mm-hmm. And we are asking them to do quite a bit. The article in the Statesman this Sunday, I thought, detailed some of the issues very well. Clearly, we have a large number of retailers that are right on the line. And they have, over 14 years, they have produced food or reduced their profit margins in other ways to promote different products. And remember, when the video lottery began, we didn't go out and create our customer base. We said to restaurants and taverns, we are going to use your customers as ours. And so that's another issue. And over those 14 years, those tavern owners and restaurateurs have changed their business operations. So just to make the point that coming in, if we were starting new, then I believe this discussion about 15% or whatever becomes a very important discussion, and maybe that's the appropriate discussion. But when you have 14 years of history, it is your sales force, you're using someone else's customers as your base of a $780 million biennial product, those are some scary issues, and it's all human conduct in the middle. So I think that's out there. My goal is trying to find where those cross points are, because clearly we want to maximize revenue, and we have seen revenue go up repeatedly at about a 45% angle. We also want to do so without destroying our network. Mm-hmm. This is a statewide product. People throughout the state voted for the lottery, and we don't want to have an I-5 corridor lottery or a Portland lottery. We want to have lottery all over the state of Oregon. And when you talk about rural locations and smaller areas, retailer compensation becomes for sure a big issue of whether or not those businesses are going to stay open. So I think the commission over the years and the legislature over the years has looked at all of those issues, and they started at 35. We have now whittled that down to 28 point something. I think that it's going to reduce below that to some manner. And I think one thing that's important is the way these tiers were designed. As sales increase, that blended rate will continue to go down. When you look at Canada, because if you look at the United States, we have the lowest commission rates in the United States for United States lotteries. Retailers in other states have higher percentages. However, they have to purchase their machines. That's the difference here. And so people would say, well, then you can't compare us to those rates. So look at Canada, because Canada has a lottery purchasing the machines and owning the machines. But even when you look at Canada, yeah, you do have 15% provinces, but you also have province that's 24.5. And so you have this range, and you have others that are 22%. So you have this range, and Canada developed starting at 35% and has ratcheted down. I think that Oregon is certainly on that road, but the challenge that we'll see if the commission votes tomorrow to approve Lion Games, over the next 2 months, that will be the debate, because the commission could not adopt a commission rate by rule until the end of March. Mm-hmm. And I know I've already been hit by many different sides, and I know that will increase, but that will be the challenge the commission will face. I have looked at the lawsuit, and so just to say that materials that have come out, which is really a brief on one side of this issue, no one has seen the brief on the other side. There is a lot of the fact that all of these studies can be attacked, the fact that all of these studies have been out there from day one, that there are a lot of other issues there. And I do think that the commission legally made a decision that will withstand analysis by the court. And I think once people see both sides of the discussion, it does clearly becomes much more complex than just here's a study, it says 15, that should be the decision.
I, I appreciate the dilemma. I prefer my seat to yours for the, at least for the next 2 months, until we get to April Fool's Day when this has this is passed.
Mr. Chair,
just let me just follow up one on that and then write to Senator Pazansky. So, on that point, Director Pym, because I completely agree with you that you're trying to find, and you can look at Canada, and I don't know if that's an apples-to-apples analysis of 15 to 22, and we're at 28.8 in terms of compensation. And there just seems to be uncertainty. Although I would argue, at least based on everything I've heard today and looked at, and given I have not at least sat down with the other side of this argument, at least spent a lot of time just kind of in passing, but it seems to me, my hunch is, we've guessed high. You know, if we look at 35 and if you look at the experience of the lottery and the compensation rates that come in and the fact that no one declined the 2004 decision, that all signed up again, it seems to me, and my bet would be, sticking with the theme of lottery, that we bet high. So given that, why on earth would we sign six-year contracts since there's so much uncertainty? Traditionally, we look at two-year, three-year contracts just to kind of weigh that out and, mm-hmm. and let the evidence flow in, especially if we might be on the high end.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we, if we're going to open these up, limit ourselves to a 2 or 3 year contract mm-hmm. so we can, on this very important decision that y'all will make, mm-hmm. get it right or close to right as we can.
Yes. And, Mr. Chair, let me say, since I've given you a big speech and I'm in the middle of litigation and everything else on this, I'm just trying to identify for you the arguments that are out there, the policy choices.
Mm-hmm.
Directly related to the six-year issue, the commission carefully analyzed that, and just I've gone back and read all the commission meetings and the exhibits and all of this, and one of the problems they had is that if they went with a 1 or 2 or 3 year contract, you have people who design business plans based on at least 5 years.
Hmm.
Some people's business plans are 10-year plans. And if you do a 1 year or a 2 year contract, what you do is you prevent and you jam up the ability for sales to take place of taverns. Because I've got a 1 year contract and I'm going to buy your tavern now and you have a lottery product. Well, you're telling me that's worth something, but I don't know, because next year it might be totally different. And so that became a major problem that the commission looked at and ultimately decided that they needed to do a six-year contract. Now, that was last year. So we are just 6 months in to a new contract, and now we're coming forward and saying, well, there are changed circumstances. We have this new game, and we need to look at this anew. One of the problems that retailers tell me is that I just signed a contract, and I'm not interested in someone coming here and telling, and again, I'm just reporting arguments because I have my own personal views, and I may be taking a legal position somewhat different than these arguments, but the argument being I signed a contract, and you state need to fulfill your contract. Other people would say, well, you can get out of this contract on 2 weeks' notice. Maybe true. However, the real difficulty that I see as a practical problem, as a lawyer, no one wins when you end up in court. And particularly the state of Oregon doesn't win in this circumstance if we end up in court to try to really determine what does this contract mean. Because if we're going to meet a goal for the state in the budget, we need to be up and running in July, and we need to have a product that is up and running in July. And so that is another factor, I think, that comes into play. The dynamic for retailers, when we talk about, well, none of them actually withdrew from video lottery. And to a large extent, that's true. We did lose some. But they were at a point where there was no contract. And at least this argument that comes forward now that I just signed a contract, that wasn't available to anyone 6 months ago. Either you have a contract or you don't. And so most people did sign up on the contract. One of the things that helped us continue to see growth in this last biennium was the situation that we were able to attract new businesses to the lottery. And so organizations like Sherry's and Elmer's. The fact that they entered into this became very important in having our transfers increase to the state of Oregon. And so those are also big businesses that really sharpen their pencils and look at what decisions have we made, and do we want to renegotiate a contract or not, and is that fair to us? And so it's a complicated issue, as I say. But I certainly support the goal in our Constitution. We need to maximize revenue as much as possible. And I think having everyone reach that cross point, that at least no one's probably going to be happy, but at least all of us go forward, that's my goal.
Mm-hmm. Senator Zansky.
Thanks. Dale, first, congratulations on your new position. I don't know if it means less or more gray hair, congratulations.
Thank you.
I guess a couple of things I wanted to follow up on. I guess some things that you've mentioned made me want to ask other questions, but reasonable rate of return, how is that defined in the sense of you ask one person, they'll say this, another say that. I guess at some point, not necessarily today, I'd like to have your responses to how the lottery is now looking at how it would define that term, reasonable rate of return. I am very concerned about where we as a state are going on more and more dependency on gambling to fund basic services, knowing what the governor wants to potentially go for setting up a dedicated funding for state highway patrol through this use, as to really what the nexus is. But I guess some of the things that I heard you say, Dale, I'm not sure if I really can conceptually take in and understand that we basically went to the taverns and said, we want your client base to basically set up our own business, mm-hmm. and we expect them to somehow deliver, I guess, this product is the individual. And I'm not really sure as to, and maybe the Restaurant Association will be glad to enlighten me as to their perspective as to how they've really generated this client base for us. It seems to me that when we look at the numbers, and one of the things I'd ask you to provide us is how many retail licenses, or how many licenses do we now have, mm-hmm. for people that are offering lottery?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know how many, as you said, we dropped the fee, but how many? I think it's continued to expand, and it's grown exponentially. And the one thing that I do find kind of amazing is that the argument that now Elmer's and some of these other more higher-end restaurants are now getting into it. My understanding, Elmer's is owned by the people who own Jasper's Deli, which is actually one of the ones that has been reviewed as to being high profiteers. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. What I see is a smart business sense saying, hey, we've done well at this level, let's take it to the next level, and we can increase our profit share that much more as compared to Elmer's coming in on their own. It's really people who've already interconnected with the lottery taking a opportunity to make a better business investment in expanding their profit ability. So those are the type of things that it seems to me that the state is in fact helping this industry to make a greater profit, because I think we all would agree that if you're not making a profit, you're not going to stay in business. And so if you were just in the hospitality of providing food and you weren't making it, you're going to look for other ways to increase that ability to stay in. And it seems to me that it's been a win-win, both really for the state and getting new revenue in, and a win-win for the restaurants and taverns that have participated in the program. And it does seem like there's a time that if we're going to abide by what the people voted for, maximizing the profits, that we do need to have better ability to readjust on what that margin is and what is a reasonable rate of return.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pozanski, those are excellent points, and I don't want to be perceived as arguing on any of this. I'm just trying to highlight the complexity of this, and I've tried to put forward some of the arguments both ways. There are a couple of things. Elmer's, I just really was concentrating more on Sherry's, but Elmer's is also a similar type of business, and just making the note that we had some other new types of businesses coming into play. You're correct. I mean, every one of those Elmer's, they can be locally owned. It has different individuals as owners. Sherry is much more corporate setup. We have had the reason I mention about the customer base. One of the studies identified that, and so that's one of the factors that I saw. And when they came forward and said, and this was over time, but one of the studies said, you know, that's what the state of Oregon did, and you have to recognize that, and that becomes a factor in trying to establish reasonable rate of return. I just that wasn't my point, just one of the ones I read in reviewing the record. The we have about 2,000 retailers presently, and in reality that has stayed about the same. As I mentioned, that and we have people go out of business and change hands and that type of thing. There's a six-month delay normally before you can become a lottery retailer for video product, because we want to make sure that they have a viable business. But that has stayed about the same. We haven't really increased much, but the addition of Sherry's with 41 locations helped us grow just a little bit, but it really hasn't increased our overall, so that stayed pretty strong. I wish there was a good definition of reasonable rate of return. As I've read back through the history here, that is asked over and over again. And I think what has happened is clearly that was the original standard, and that was supposed to be the focus of the original study, and that's how it came forward to 35%. But and maybe different individuals and different commissions and different bodies have looked at it and had their own definition, but unfortunately we do not have a clear statement there. I do think that the rate challenge that it's presently taking place of the commission's reduction, the lottery commission's reduction of the retailer commission rate, which took effect the 1st of July this year. We're in the Court of Appeals right now, and perhaps there would be some definition of reasonable rate of return out of that litigation. But unfortunately, I can't point you to something. I can just show you the history of 12 years and different people at different times put their own spin on it.
Thank you.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Penn, I think some of the arguments that you have been mentioning to that as, are important, and I think at the same standpoint, it is important then to, you know, for the record, indicate that there are other arguments, you know, that counter those, that I think that they're really important to understand. I think, first of all, when you talk about the customer base, using the customer base is certainly valid in starting any type of initiative. But as we go forward, whether from the commission standpoint or, you know, your leadership in running the organization, is to look that we don't want to get to that bell curve point in which, now the mission of the lottery is that the lottery is the customer base for a retailer's incentive to stay in business. I mean, the original intent was not to create state-supported gaming organizations in which we'll serve a hamburger to you to keep you at the terminal. The idea was you had a hamburger outfit that would help support the restaurant to be more successful, as well as supporting the state. And you know, if it evolves to where the primary concern is the customers for the gaming facility, then I don't think we meet our constitutional requirement. The other issue is in terms of trying to decide a percentage, and I understand the difficulty there, and I agree with the chair that I'm glad we're on this side of that table rather than you and the commission on this. However, clearly, if you start an enterprise and you have whatever enterprise that is,
and you have a prediction of smaller revenues versus the investment of time, then you're going to need a greater return in order to support that. Mm. As those returns grow and diminishes the investment that you have to make to maintain it, you know, that justification changes. I mean, if you have a vending machine, as you know, and we put two candy bars in that vending machine, you're not going to make a lot of money. And you're saying, what do I need to return in order to have that vending machine? Mm-hmm. You're going to say, I'm going to need a lot because I'm not going to sell much with just two choices of candy bars. Mm-hmm. That same vending machine, if you put 50 items in it, is going to generate a lot more activity. No more activity on my part, and therefore my ability to, my percentage can go down, but my take is going to be significantly higher, and I'm going to be content mm-hmm. with that. And those are, I think those are just the types of things I know you weigh, but as we all know with numbers and everything else, if you don't look at the overall picture, you can come to a totally different conclusion. The one question I do want to ask you, I'm curious because of your background, and we've met many times in judiciary before.
Mm-hmm.
Also appealing for dollars and other things from the state to support law enforcement, and having been one who worked very hard to find a nexus between the auto insurance surcharge to support state police that didn't go very far, although I mm-hmm. still think it was a brilliant idea. I'm curious from your perspective and legal perspective is how the governor is going to get around the constitutional limitation. As you mentioned, we've done a great job of supporting economic development, education, mm-hmm. parks, and salmon, because those are the limitations of the lottery, and how we get mm-hmm. to supporting the state police. And any advice you'd be able to give him on how he might be able to end up with his result with this, because I think it's kind of a stretch.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, I did support that car insurance.
And you did, and I appreciate that very much for the record.
Good.
No, yeah. I do think that clearly a couple of committees, I think Ways and Means, has stated that they want an Attorney General's opinion on that precise issue. But I think that the definition of economic development in this area, there have been some prior Attorney General's opinions on that, and it is not a very precise term. And I know from discussing this with the governor's office, one thing they look at is, as they have worked on economic development and trying to bring business to Oregon, the first question they're always asked is, tell us about your public safety system, your policing environment, your support for state police, and those types of things. And so they see it very directly connected in their ability to promote economic development for Oregon. That's one issue, and I'm sure that will be discussed at great length over the next few months. But I believe that's the governor's intent as he's viewed that and believes that that's an appropriate interpretation of economic development and why it could be dedicated funding. That isn't something I've tried to examine. Our job is to produce the dollars, and your job is to spend the dollars. So that's one of the things that I liked about this, because I have been there begging for dollars many, many years. So.
Well, both of us do very good at our assignments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Really appreciate the time, Director Penn. Just one, we have kind of gone back and forth in what the legislature's role in this whole commission issue is. If we were dissatisfied with the decision that's made, or lack of decision that's made in March, do you have an opinion of what role the legislature could play in setting the commission rates if a bill were to advance to the governor's desk?
Well, Mr. Chair, I not being in this position long enough to really understand the issues there, I would encourage you to participate. I know Senator Metzger's coming tomorrow, and certainly these are all public hearings, and we would facilitate any kind of presentation. I have several people who have presented us with letters that we will read tomorrow from legislators. We'll have several legislators on this issue of line gains. The retailer compensation one, we have to have a public hearing, and we have to have a public commission meeting in March. And so there'll be a lot of time for debate, input, and certainly we'd be very open to receiving that to give to the commission. And hopefully, when we get all done with that process, as I said, everyone will be able to maybe not all join hands, but feel like, hey, this was a legitimate, good process, and we can move forward from here. So I try not to look beyond that at this point.
So I'm still trying to glean an answer out of that. If the legislature has a role or does not, speaking with Mr. Perry yesterday, he indicated that his thought was there's two different opinions on that. One is that the legislature really constitutionally does not have a role in setting those commission rates. And I just, perhaps you don't have an opinion, but if you did, I'd welcome it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd simply say that clearly the decision is with the commission. Now, could the legislature give direction, that type of thing? I know that in the past the legislature has had bills introduced, and none of those have ever come forward. And so I haven't been part of that debate, and I just am, again, trying to emphasize the positive that I think any input is a complex decision, and the commissioners want to have as much information as they can. And I know beginning the process, it certainly is their decision to begin.
Mm-hmm. So. Very deft and nimble answers, and we took more of your time than we had asked for, so we really appreciate your time and the position that you're in for the next couple of months, and appreciate your service to the state.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
appreciate
thank it. You. Thank you. With that, most of our orientation has concluded. Paul?
Mr. Chair, we did have a discussion yesterday about the local option school property tax, and I just make a copy available at the committee of research report Steve had done that has the percentages on the elections on local options. It shows the individual districts who are receiving the local option equalization grants, I think was one of the questions. Mm-hmm. And you can see the history there at page 6 is the history of passing and failing, cause of failure, whether it was a vote issue or the double majority issue.
Do you know that offhand? I'm searching for it.
It's on page 6. Under cause of failure. It has the vote in one column, and there's, you can see in 2001 there were three of them. In all the years, that was the only time that's happened. Hmm. Of course, there is a selectivity going on there. Mm-hmm. And the higher that threshold gets when you have high turnouts, then the more likely you're going to see districts using the general election as their target. Steve made some comment about student size, about the tendency on the medium. You can see where he drew that comment from. The medium-sized ADM schools, 1,000 to 5,000, had failed 84% of the time, which was the highest percentage failure. The larger and smaller ones, actually the smaller ones, had over 50% pass rate through those 19 districts that have tried it. On the next page, page 7, you can see the tendency of high value, assessed value for student districts do have a higher percentage success rate, and of course that's something that has long been discussed, and the evidence shows that so far. And then finally, there is a fairly small, so less than $500,000 in this biennium, local option equalization grants available, and you can see the districts that have been available to receive that on page 8, and who's gotten the equalization grants over the last three fiscal years there, and only a total of $600,000 has been allocated. Now, the largest districts that received them was Pendleton each of the 3 years of their local option.
Hmm.
So it hasn't been used.
Is that going to sunset, or is that just permanent in this equalization formula?
Mr. Chair, it won't sunset, but the key is how much money Ways and Means puts in that fund. Of course, we've had it, when it first started up, we had a zero amount in it.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on how many dollars flow into that fund.
That are allocated into it.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you. We'll turn tomorrow with, I think we have some bills up.
Mr. Chair, we have Senate Bill 267, 268, and Senate Bill 29 up for public hearing and possible work session tomorrow.
Great. Thanks. We're adjourned. Thanks, Mazin. Thank you, Barbara.